Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Social media is playing an increasingly important role in politics and policy. It influences the way our political discussions take place, and it changes the way politicians communicate to the public and to one another. In this week's episode, we're discussing governance in 280 characters. Joining us is Matthias Lufkin. He's author of the Twiplomacy Study, which looks at the way Twitter and social networks are used by world leaders. We'll also hear from Charlie Warsell. He's a columnist and writes on the intersection of media, politics, and technology for the New York Times. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcus Kunalakis. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. This broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Marcus.
Thank you for joining us today. We're looking at leadership and governance in the age of social media. And of course, this is something that is quite topical. Anyone who reads the media today will see that many of our leaders are using these new forms of social media, Twitter in particular, to communicate not merely to their fellow politicians, but to the world at large and, of course, citizens. This is a fairly new approach. It's using new tools, relatively. And what it's done is it's taken out the traditional media, often from the middle, which is what the media is known to be. So there is a disintermediation going on, allowing for a dialogue from politicians direct to citizens. So as we look at this shift in politics, can we also look at how leaders utilize social networks to communicate with their constituents, how they use it to control the narrative, how they use it to galvanize support or market test new ideas? Matthias and Charlie, either of you can jump in.
So I have been sort of watching this phenomenon play out from afar as a member of the media, but also as somebody who reports on a lot of these technology companies and has been covering them basically since their inception. And, you know, these technology companies started out with this idea of raw connection and connection as a universal good, and the idea that people speaking to each other in this, disintermediated way, like you say, is always going to be a positive. Cutting out the middleman in every way is a step on the road to that utopian ideal, and especially as it relates to dissidents and lawmakers and people, you know, in charge. I think you saw the phenomenon with Twitter, especially early in its existence, with celebrities. The idea that celebrities can go straight to the people, have these conversations they wouldn't be able to have with their fans, and I think that there was a lot of hype around this idea, especially as it related to politics. The idea that democracy would be able to flourish in new ways if politicians didn't have to go through that middleman. And I think what we've slowly seen is the reality of this, which is that this phenomenon does have some positives, right? It is always good to be able to go straight to the source and to have that, especially as a record, to have politicians speaking in their own words. But I think it's a very complicated picture that has been painted. What we have seen is this ability to cut out the middleman, to cut out the press as a way to hijack narratives, as a way to bend the truth, as a way to manipulate the audience instead of have an honest and open dialogue with them. I think the sort of story of social media writ large over the last decade or so is the ways in which the promise of these services has sort of been undermined by the reality of how humans are. They are manipulative. And we see that play out in politics, obviously, with people like our president, Donald Trump, in a sort of unprecedented fashion. So I think it's a very complicated picture right now. But what we're seeing is that this is sort of this is not the utopian ideal that we thought it would be.
Matthias, you're sitting in Switzerland, where many of us consider that country a utopia of sorts. Are you also experiencing that the use of these new tools to actually be a double-edged sword as well, whether it be in politics, but specifically in politics, actually? Are you seeing this very same phenomenon?
Well, it is very interesting that actually social media usage by Swiss politicians is not very well developed because you don't have national elections. It's really on a cantonal level. And in Switzerland, you still win elections by using the local TV rather than having a social media presence. But what is interesting, you know, and I think it's not a new phenomenon. I mean, we've been following this for the past, you know, decade. I remember I set up the Twitter account of the World Economic Forum back in 2007. And when I joined BCW, Burson, Cohn & Wolf, the PR firm, we basically decided we should look at how leaders, how politicians, how world leaders are using these platforms, starting out with Twitter, but also then branching out into Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and LinkedIn and even Snapchat. Not that we have much data about Snapchat, but what is interesting to see is I think initially politicians realize that, you know, in order to make an impact during an election, you have to mobilize your voters, your constituents. And the best thing to do that is to go direct, is to reach out via Twitter, you know, building a Twitter community or a Facebook community. And, you know, our study shows that actually on Facebook, world leaders have their biggest audiences. On average, median average of their Facebook pages is twice as much as that on Twitter. So it's really kind of Facebook, which is there for community building. And one thing they have learned over the years is that, well, initially, social media was really designed to have a conversation with your followers, kind of direct interactions. That's what also why many politicians did not want to go into social media. They were afraid, you know, to have to answer, you know, every single question. But now they understand that they can use social media just like any other channel as a broadcast channel, you know. And the examples are, you know, look at Pope Francis. He's kind of only doing one-way communication on Twitter, as does President Donald Trump. You know, it's kind of, they have realized that they can reach, you know, a large following. And the beauty is that whenever they post something, whenever Donald Trump posts something, it will be headline news on U.S. cable networks, you know, kind of breaking news. Donald Trump fired off another tweet. So kind of that's the new way to that politicians will use these platforms really as a one-way communication channel.
Right. So, Matthias, though, what Charlie was suggesting, though, is that while it is this opportunity and this ability to build this dialogue between a community or even individual constituents and politicians themselves, there really is a side of it that it can be dangerous. He really suggested that there is this potential for a negative evolution. Do you see it, however, as a net positive that suddenly a political a politician or even a political party has the ability to cut out the middleman, as Charlie says, and go straight to the voters, straight to the people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what has happened. The middleman, the media, the intermediary has been cut out, has been sidelined. The media is still very important. Traditional, you know, media channels, be it TV, radio or print, is still very, very important as an amplifier. But, you know, world leaders can now go directly to their audiences. Do they really need to do press conferences or press briefings if they can do a Facebook Live and then basically choose which questions they want to answer, because they do get these questions in writing from, you know, from their followers? So I think the media has definitely been intermediated, and politicians can go direct. And they do go direct.
You now relatively recently joined this establishment in media. You're now at the New York Times. Matthias is suggesting that, in fact, it's actually better, perhaps, for democratic dialogue and for development of democratic engagement, that your institution has a lesser role to play in that dialogue between citizen and politician.
I think it's complicated. obviously, cutting out the press and you know, I think one of the examples that was used there is only answering the questions that you want to answer and getting them in writing from your followers. I think that is a potentially dangerous precedent to set. Only, you know, answering the things that you want to answer. I think it's complicated though. If you look at, you know, in America, a good sort of example of this in the analog world is the White House press corps and the press secretary holding briefings, as you know, a semi-frequent spectacle previously that's now become less and less. There's a group of people in the press corps that argue this is a good thing. This was, you know, a relatively staged production in which reporters grandstand with questions and, you know, the administration, whichever administration it is, answers them in a stilted way. Not too much is learned or understood. And really, it's an exercise that doesn't yield a lot for the average citizen.
Does that quality also change, the quality of that conversation, or maybe the quality of the of what it is that is discussed? But please go on with your second point.
Oh, that there's another camp out there that says that this is actually a good thing. It's freed people up. It's freed journalists up from that obligation. And lets them focus on, you know, in more investigative work, in running down, you know, deeper stories, in sort of doing the work, the hardest work of journalism, which is exposing something that wouldn't normally be exposed to the public. And so there's this dueling idea here. And I think that when you look at social media, you do have this ability to bypass the middleman, and I do think that is helpful in establishing new voices and making sure that, you know, the legacy voices don't dredge up you know, too much of the conversation. But I do worry about the idea that the politicians get to pick and choose their moments, get to pick and choose their answers, that there's this sense of unaccountability disguised as transparency.
There's also been, it seems, Charlie, you're saying that, in fact, in some ways there can be a reallocation of resources, perhaps not having too many reporters sitting, for example, in the White House waiting for a, you know, whatever it is that wants to be handed down upon high, and maybe reallocating some of those reporting resources into the investigative field, for example. But what we're seeing, in fact, is the collapse of the business model writ large for the media, for newspapers, perhaps not the New York Times any longer, but certainly other journalistic organs are being challenged. So it isn't really in many ways necessarily that reallocation of resources. It's really the disappearance of some of those resources. And perhaps, Matthias, as you look at this, a substitution for this traditional means of communication between politician and citizen by the evolving tools that in many ways have killed that business model for the traditional media.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If you look at some of the social media interviews that some heads of state and government are doing, I'm thinking about the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz. His team is absolutely brilliant on Instagram, asking people to send their questions. And Instagram is interesting because especially Instagram stories and question stickers, where you can basically put your question or comment, but it will not be shown publicly. And that's a big change to, you know, compared to Twitter or Facebook. And basically they then choose which questions they want to answer. Obviously, these are not hard questions from journalists, but these are kind of questions from anyone who follows the Austrian Chancellor. And obviously, they're very, very light on substance. Well, even the German foreign minister did a Q&A on Instagram, and he was asked, you know, how does he deal with jet lag on his travels? So obviously, it's you cannot compare that to traditional press conferences. And I'm not in favor, doing away with traditional press conference and the role of the media. I think the role of the media is absolutely crucial in our democracies. And I hope it's not, you know, that they will be disintermediated through the use of these social media channels. So I think it is absolutely vital that we have the fourth estate.
So, Matthias, if I can follow up, has it, in your estimation, and I know you researched this as well and have looked rather in depth throughout the world, but in particular in Europe, at the use of these technologies, have you noticed the way, or perhaps I should say, the style of politician has changed? You know, when we look at this, or even the approach that politicians have used to use and leverage these new media. I will use an example. In the United States, early on in politics, when television was introduced during the debates for presidential campaigns, we recognized that, for example, television and the visual images had a very definitive qualitative shift in the way that we looked at our politicians. During the Nixon-Kennedy debates, it was true that those who listened to the debates on radio found Richard Nixon to be overwhelmingly convincing in that debate. However, those who watched on this new medium of television where suddenly politics was brought into your living room, noticed that Richard Nixon had a 5 o'clock shadow, was perhaps not as handsome or as suave as John F. Kennedy, and they overwhelmingly decided that, in fact, JFK was the preferred candidate. Are you noticing that this new medium is creating a new type of politician or politician star or change in style?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the use of social media and new social media channels, and I'm thinking particularly about Instagram and Instagram stories, because this is basically a social network where you don't have the negativity that you have on Twitter and on Facebook, but you know, going direct and showing a little bit of, you know, your private life. And a great example there is the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who does occasional Facebook lives, just, you know, Friday evening at home. In the Prime Minister's office, she'll do a Facebook Live, give a 5-minute update on what she has been doing the week and, you know, what's coming next. And these Facebook Lives, which she does herself, talking, you know, holding the mobile device. It doesn't seem that there is any advisor in the room with her, apart from her husband, who's preparing dinner. So this is a whole new way of doing social media, talking directly to your constituents. She doesn't take live questions during her Facebook Lives, but this is kind of a new way of showing that you're listening, or that you're showing you know, what you do. I also already mentioned the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz. He does the same, you know. So basically, he has a social media reporter with him all the time, whether he's going around Austria or, you know, on his international trips, who will basically chronicle his day, what he's doing, and every now and then he then, you know, addresses his audience directly in 15-second videos. And other examples are the president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, and Argentinian president Mauricio Macri. He has been using Instagram and Snapchat really to chronicle what he does. And it is quite interesting because these two social networks are mainly addressed to a younger audience, especially Snapchat. But the idea behind is that the people he reached 3, 4, 5 years ago on Snapchat will now be able to vote for him. So if he was able to create that community, they will probably, you know, might vote for him in his re-election bid. So basically, these are the politicians who know how to to use these social media platforms. Obviously, they might not be, you know, there tweeting themselves. They have a team. They have teams who do this, and they have these social media reporters who follow them throughout the day. And this, I think, is quite interesting because it gives us an insight in, you know, what they do every day. And the beauty is, especially with the Argentinian president, Mauricio Macri, their aim is to give the people he meets, a voice on his social media platforms. So it's not always Macri talking, but it's really kind of who is he interacting with? That can be, you know, the Argentinian on the road, on the street that he meets, or, you know, another world leader. So this is quite interesting. And I'll give you another example of a leader who has not signed up to social media and who's actually given up on social media, and that's the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Obviously, she's on her fourth term and can't be re-elected, and she basically, in the beginning of February, decided to delete her Facebook page, and she was the most followed European leader on Facebook with 2.4 million followers, but she never really got into social media. She wasn't running the page herself. It was run by her party, so it wasn't very personal. And basically, she decided she doesn't need it. She doesn't need it for re-election, and she doesn't really want it to reach out, even, you know, after she leaves office, with a personal page on Facebook or on Twitter. She's one of the few G7 leader, the only G7 leader who does not have a personal Twitter account, for example. So that's a, you know, kind of, and I think there you can see the new leaders and the old leaders, you know, those who embrace these digital platforms and those who basically say, sorry, that's too much work for me.
That's fascinating. And so it's interesting to see that Angela Merkel has retired from social media before she retires from office. Charlie, one of the things that was really intimated here by Matthias is that this real-time ability to communicate perhaps is focusing and maybe bringing about a new type of politician, or maybe an old type of politician that we once had before the mass media, which is one who can represent themselves fully. This question of authenticity that we often say is so key to how we elect our leaders, how we regard our leaders. It seems that what Matthias is saying is that, in fact, the medium that is evolving, that has evolved over these last few years, this social medium, is allowing for that type of authenticity on the one hand for the politician, but also he is suggesting that a new voice and perhaps the power of citizens' voices is also arising within this new social media environment.
I want to just quickly address a little what came before with regard to what kind of politician can come out of this social media environment, and I think that a lot of the previous points make a lot of sense in sort of the most optimistic lens of this. I do think that there is this ability for authenticity for new people to break through in this way, and there are good examples of that happening in America. I also think, when you talk about who's getting heard, you have to think of the ways in which these platforms distribute information. The platforms prioritize engagement sort of above all else, and engagement is driven by being able to say things that are incendiary, things that can provoke, things that, you know, that are sort of appealing to this algorithmic system. And I think, you know, you see in places like the United States with the election of Donald Trump, in the Philippines with Duterte, the ability for certain people who are really divisive, who are, you know, great at staying in the headlines by being aggressive, by, you know, dividing, by alienating, those people are able to sort of capture the attention of these algorithms and able to sort of stay in front. You know, I think if you look at in the 2016 election with media coverage of, you know, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, you saw this sort of asymmetry there, in part because of the way that Donald Trump was able to use his social media platforms, be it his Twitter account, be it Facebook, to to, you know, stay on his message. And a lot of times that message was divisive. It was provoking. It was something that helped program the media. And so as a result, you know, the negative side of this, and I hate to always be the one pouring cold water, but the negative side of this is that those who seek to divide, to sow outrage, those people have sort of a leg up on these platforms rather than people who are necessarily trying always to unite. Because, you know, when it comes to something like engagement, divisive issues do very well. Negative things do very well. So I think that's the one side of it. That's the sort of the dark side of that. On the plus side, I think you do see people like the New Zealand Prime Minister, or like in America here, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has used, you know, all of her platforms in tandem to constantly be creating content, to constantly bring people behind the scenes of what it's like to be a freshman congresswoman, to come into Washington. She's really creating a bond with those people and getting a message out in a way where people feel like she's being transparent, like people are being heard. So I do think there is that positive, but I think we have to look at the negative elements of this and the way in which, you know, the architecture of these platforms does also create a lot of divide and discord.
That's interesting, Charlie, because what you're suggesting is that what we used to call the silent majority perhaps is becoming the algorithmically amplified minority, not that they're becoming it, but that there is an algorithmically amplified minority that is in fact getting a disproportionately stronger voice in our politics, and that they are in fact affecting it in some way that is qualitatively different, perhaps focusing on more of an extremist or a more incendiary politics. It's interesting, but do you think that in this shift from to a more perhaps polarizing politics because of what is favored by the platforms themselves, by the algorithms themselves, are you also seeing, and perhaps 2018 is a representation of this, are you seeing greater engagement of the body politic? I mean, we saw in 2018 that in fact in the United States, there were many more voters who suddenly came out to the polling places.
You know, I don't know if we can attribute that directly to social media. Obviously, the midterm elections in some capacity were stoked by the 2016 election, the contentious nature of that, the contentious and divisive nature of the Trump presidency. So I think there's a lot of factors there. I do think, however, that that folks on both sides of this equation, right? You have the Trumps or the Ocasio-Cortezes of the world who are sort of doing similar things, but one sort of seems to be focused on positive change, the other sort of maybe on a little more of a negative message or a divisive message. I think we have seen a deeper engagement from the citizenry in general. I mean, politics has sort of become, and I think largely in part to the conversation and the way that we live on social media now, it's become sort of in America at least, a national entertainment. It's become a spectacle. It's not unlike a sporting event where you have your sides and you're rooting, very aggressively. And, this tribalism, I think, is hardening around the prospect of social media. But one thing that does do is it does bring more civic engagement. People are more in tune with that. People are spending more time listening to politicians. They're spending more time listening to analysis of those politicians. I'm always startled going around in my daily life and listening to people talk about politics with such granularity. You know, they know who the Secretary of Agriculture is, and I don't remember that, 10 years ago. They understand certain policies. They're fluent in the idea of what this Green New Deal might be and how this, the positives and negatives and feasibility of that. So you are seeing this hyper engagement of the citizenry, and whether that's a factor of Donald Trump in the 2016 election, it's unclear, but it's certainly being amplified by social media.
We've been hearing from Matthias Lufkin and Charlie Warsell on leadership and governance in the age of social media. After the break, join us for the second half of our conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Matthias Lufkin, author of a study which looks at the way Twitter and social networks are used by world leaders. He's joined by Charlie Warsell, who's a columnist at the New York Times. He writes on the intersection of media, politics, and technology. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcus Kounalakis. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
So Matthias, Charlie really said, look, you know, yes, there are some very positive, there are a great number of positives, in fact, even perhaps this greater engagement by the citizenry. But he also talked about the negative factors. How do you balance out, the positives and negatives? And do you come out net positive, as you said earlier?
Well, unfortunately, negativity seems to have the upper hand, but I wouldn't put it on the algorithms of the platform. It's just, one-line tweet, a zinger on Twitter just works better, and basically will get picked up by the media, will be amplified by social media users. So it's not the algorithm that make this the tweet trending, but it is absolutely clear that, divisive messages seem to have the upper hand and are being picked up by the media rather than, positive messages where you have world leaders interacting with each other. So it's, I think that's the nature of the beast, that, negativity seems to trump here. But I think it's, it's really important that we look at, some of the positive messages that have been, that have been shared on social media. Unfortunately, they don't really get the same, pickup as the negative ones.
Matthias, you just said that we don't necessarily take a look at how world leaders interact with each other. And this is something that you, of course, have spent a fair amount of time researching. You have even coined a term, or maybe it's not your term, but you use the term twiplomacy, meaning Twitter diplomacy. This is something that is, I think, relatively new as well. We've just focused on how politicians talk to their own citizenry, perhaps to citizenry of other nations, to try and convince them of a platform or to spread their ideology. But really, it is now what you're focusing on is the use of these platforms to not only be able to have a dialogue between leaders, but also to the creation and explanation of certain types of policies where the United States can in fact currently talk to Venezuela and perhaps even threaten Venezuela with certain types of policies. Could you talk a bit about your research and how it is that this is manifesting itself in the world of Twitter and the world of diplomacy?
That's exactly, what we've been looking at with this twiplomacy study since 2012 is kind of how world leaders are engaging with each other. Obviously, we do every year put out a ranking, you know, who's the most followed. But, you know, what is really interesting is who is the best connected? Because on Twitter, you can see who follows who. And there we see it's actually the European External Action Service. That's the foreign policy branch of the European Union, which is the best, you know, has the most connections with their peers. They have 132 connections. In second position is the UK Foreign Office with 130 connections. And in third place, the Russian Foreign Ministry. So basically, these foreign offices are really intent on creating mutual connections on Twitter, following each other on the platform. This is really interesting to how you can use Twitter to have, you know, direct interaction, direct contact. So once you follow each other on Twitter, you can actually send private messages on the platform. And I can tell you that I have received a number of direct messages from world leaders, heads of state, heads of government and foreign ministries with our Twiplomacy account. And I know there have been exchanges, also private messages sent from other foreign ministers to foreign ministries. Twitter is really the channel for digital diplomacy. In our latest study, we saw that 97% of the 193 UN member countries, the governments have a presence on Twitter. There's actually only five countries where the governments are not on Twitter, and that's North Korea, Laos, Swaziland, Turkmenistan, and Nicaragua. So this is quite interesting. How do you use Twitter to address certain leaders directly? And candidate Donald Trump tweeted, "Mexico will pay for the wall." The former Mexican president actually replied directly to Donald Trump. And Enrique Peña Nieto tweeted, "Mexico will never pay for the wall." The thing is, he tweeted it in Spanish. Had he tweeted it in English, I think that would have been, you know, made the front page of the New York Times. And also, I don't know if you remember when Barack Obama flew to Cuba, the State Department opened a before they had reestablished their diplomatic relations, the State Department started to follow the Cuban foreign ministry. And a couple of hours later, the Cuban foreign ministry followed the State Department. So that was kind of the first step to reestablishing the diplomatic relations. So in 2017, we saw quite a number of leaders reacting to Donald Trump and to his way of tweeting, and one very few, as the former Mexican president, would reply directly. Some would even not follow the real Donald Trump account, but follow the official presidential account, which is the POTUS account for President of the United States. And what's interesting, the reply or the response of the French president, Emmanuel Macron, he actually used the slogan "Make America Great Again" to change that to "Make the Planet Great Again," and hoping that the U.S. administration would not leave the Paris Accord. Unfortunately, the U.S. did leave the accord. And so that was quite interesting to see how world leaders try to influence each other through social media namely on Twitter. But now what we see is more on Instagram, visual diplomacy. You all remember from last year at the G7 summit in Canada, this picture that was shared by the German government of Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron facing off Donald Trump in intense negotiations on the sidelines right. of this of the summit. That picture in itself was first shared on Instagram, then, you know, went viral on Twitter and everywhere. That really showed, you know, the tensions between the allies of the G7 summit.
If I can just also try to get Charlie in here, because, you know, I think he sits in Missoula, Montana. He has a very different lens perhaps on this, because what you're quite focused on is the international engagement of these social media platforms, leader to leader at this point, and perhaps even leader to foreign citizen at this point. One of the things that I've noticed is not just the use of Twitter. In fact, I was contacted once because I had an engagement with an embassy, and the phone call came into my phone call, and what was used was the WhatsApp application, which of course has some level of encrypted reality to it, so that I could have an encrypted phone call with someone. But what you're saying is this very quality of disintermediation that we have seen between politician and citizen is in fact currently happening between leaders. That in fact, where we used to rely on foreign ministries or state departments to send back and forth cables to talk about a type of policy that was being pursued, that too has fallen by the wayside by those leaders who have embraced this new technology. Charlie, are you aware of this, and are you seeing this, and do you think that the folks who are living in Middle America are affected in any way by this?
Well, I don't know about the effect. I mean, I'm seeing it just like anyone else is. What I'm curious about is the actual effect of this. Whether, you know, is this posturing, is this grandstanding, or is, you know, is there actual change that is coming from this? I think that's relatively hard to tell at the moment. I think we can see some of these, you know, these leaders following back at each other, or the term of art in America here is, you know, clapping back at somebody with a witty retort, which is something similar to debate, I suppose. I see those things more as efforts to program the media, as efforts to get their story picked up when the Mexican president responds to Donald Trump. It's not necessarily because he's hoping that he'll change Donald Trump's mind. I think it's more, you know, hoping to show some defiance there to signal to his own people that he's standing up to this. So I'm not entirely sure that what we're seeing is a new is something, you know, really new in any way. I think this is more a reflection of something that people who've been covering these technology companies and studying the internet have seen for a long time, which is that, you know, the internet is real life, and that's increasingly become very common. The things that happen across social media aren't just, you know, something that happens in a vacuum. They have real world consequences, whether it's the way that President Donald Trump tweets at North Korean leaders using, you know, derisive terms like Rocket Man and sort of escalating international tensions across the board. What is happening across the internet and sort of in that public sphere is real. And I think that social media just sort of gives us a new lens with which to see that. One last thing that was brought up there that I think is worth mentioning is the ways in which these leaders can communicate. And I think that it's obviously a plus if we can see it. And that bit of transparency, even if it is grandstanding, is good. I think where we're going to start to see more and more concern is over encrypted channels, you know, something like WhatsApp. In the news last week was the notion that, Trump advisor Jared Kushner was communicating with foreign governments across WhatsApp in an encrypted way. If those things are happening and we can't see them, if no government agencies can see them, that is potentially difficult and concerning. So, you know, I think this is one of these situations where you're seeing a lot of good and you're seeing some potential for misuse or to sort of continue to stoke fears and outrage. So you've really got to take the good with the bad.
Right. So just all of this in a much more real-time way. But, you know, when you said that it perhaps is merely a means by which to posture or to grandstand, in many ways, that has always been the case for diplomacy. Posturing and grandstanding is, in fact, a way to negotiate for a particular position or a particular policy. As you said, Charlie, you know, this the use of Twitter during the conflict, or at least the confrontation between the leader of North Korea and the United States president, was exacerbated through this immediacy and through the types of language that was, I think, by anybody's reckoning, undiplomatic. But the point, of course, being that we have now used these tools, we, the world, in fact, and the leadership are using these tools to move policies along, perhaps at a more accelerated pace. And one of the things that diplomacy has traditionally offered has been a slowing down of the process. Matthias, when you look at this evolution and the types of tools that are being used, is there this acceleration? Is that threaten traditional diplomacy?
Well, as you said, there is some talk about, do we still need physical embassies? If leaders can, contact each other and talk to each other on social media, do we really need the ambassador who will bring the, letter of protest to the foreign ministry in a certain country? So basically social media has done away with that. And we see, these negotiations and these talks, are publicly conducted on Twitter. The latest example is between the Minister of Information of Pakistan and the Indian Foreign Minister. They had a little Twitter row just a couple of days ago. So, it is very scary when you have these messages, being sent by Donald Trump, apparently personally and without being vetted by his advisors, or without the message carefully crafted, and that's what we've seen during the spat with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which was very, very scary. If you just take those 280 characters, and nobody had been briefed on that that kind of the wording and any policy change that comes from the White House. So that is, I think, very, very scary. But luckily, we don't have, most world leaders have a team, where they basically think very carefully about when to go publicly just with a tweet.
So Matthias, just to answer your own question then, it seems as if you're saying, you're answering the question, which is, do we need embassies? Do we need foreign ministries? And the answer seems to be yes on your part.
Well, I think you still need embassies. But then again, look at how Israel has opened up a digital embassy to the Gulf states, because there are no diplomatic relations with the Arab states in the Gulf. They have used social media, and they have an Arab Twitter account, which is the account of their mission, to connect with the Arab speaking population on Twitter. And I think that's an example of, look, do you really need a presence, a physical presence? I still think, yes, you do. But, social media channels could, help kind of smooth that communication. And yes, you can actually try to influence other populations through social media, or populations in other countries through social media. We've seen Donald Trump taking a stance on the politics in Britain and in France.
Right. So what it sounds like is that social media can be very effective, very interesting in terms of public diplomacy. So the leadership of one nation being able to talk to the people of another country to convince them or to attract them to the types of policies and ideologies of the nation sending out the message. But that perhaps when it comes to the official level, the leader-to-leader, the state-to-state dialogue, that you do need these traditional tools of diplomacy, the embassies, the ministries, the slow thinking, slow cogitating type of diplomacy that has often prevented things from occurring hastily.
Well, I think they're no longer slow thinking. They will, most foreign ministries have teams who monitor what's being said on social media and are very, very reactive to any misinformation, disinformation, and to put the record straight. So I think, and they're also now using these tools, to make a point, to push their agenda on certain topics. And, that's the way it should be, I think. If you consider the State Department, I think there's 200 people working on their social media channels. Yes, they do see and read most of the what goes out, what is said in the different countries about the United States.
Right. So, Charlie, you actually brought up the specter of encrypted. I guess I did by saying that I had been contacted by someone in a foreign embassy via WhatsApp. The question of encrypted communications. So, if the arc of the evolution of these technologies is that we go from these traditional forms of ministries and embassies to perhaps what Matthias is suggesting, much more of a direct interaction via social media and technology tools that allow for greater transparency, more engagement by a broader populace, and perhaps even leaders who are willing to share their ideas and their policies on a public platform, to this now new relationship, which is leaders, in fact, speaking even more privately with other leaders, cutting out their bureaucratic institutions, or perhaps, as some would regard, the administrative state, to have a dialogue that cuts out the democratic features of a nation, to perhaps even the ability of other nations to shut down entirely conversations with other leaders and other nations through an information sovereignty reality, where in fact the nation of Russia can decide to just close down all communications. Where do you see things moving? Do you see things evolving so that leaders are strictly speaking to each other in these private channels, and where we are unable to share in the process, and even the potential dangers of misguided diplomacy?
You know, I think there's a difference between, you know, the taking out the middleman of the media and sort of the, you know, the commentary class, and I think, you know, you can make an argument that that's a positive for politics in general, but I think there's a difference between that and, you know, taking away oversight in any way, and I don't even mean oversight that the public gets to see. It doesn't have to be completely transparent. It's, you know, there are plenty of cables that are sent or that have been traditionally sent that, you know, we the public aren't privy to, but that, you know, have some sort of oversight. And I think taking away that level with, you know, just sheer encrypted channels is something we actually really have to worry about going forward, and we have to make sure that you know, that there's not the possibility for these conversations that even, you know, people at high levels of the government can't be privy to. But to sort of go back to the idea of whether we need these embassies or whether we need these classic diplomatic channels, I think it speaks to the idea of social media in general as taking away a lot of friction when it comes to communication. And I think something that we're seeing in the past, you know, 5 years or so with some of the negative effects of social media is this idea that friction isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes friction is a really good thing. That idea, especially as it relates to diplomacy, that, you know, taking one's time, that huddling, crafting a message it can be a positive. You know, that's sort of what we think of when we think of diplomacy. And I think something to keep an eye on is the way that how this frictionless communication builds new leaders. You know, if you look at people like Donald Trump, at some of the other far-right populist movements and their leaders, there is this idea of the frictionless communication, straight to the people, unvarnished. That can be very polarizing. That can be very divisive, as I mentioned earlier. I think we need to think of how these new types of leaders are going to come around. Is social media going to usher in a new generation of lawmaker or head of state that, you know, that really does sort of just fly off the cuff, that sort of works in an improvisational manner because that is what the, you know, the medium, the broadcast medium, the diplomacy medium dictates? And that's something that I think we're only starting to see the very beginnings of the contours of that. And I think it's something that that we have to sort of be on alert for, because this friction can sometimes be very helpful. It can be stabilizing, and the frictionless part of social media can be a destabilizing force.
Charlie, that's fascinating, this whole idea of frictionless diplomacy and how it's evolving. Certainly, you talked about the taking out the middleman but not taking out oversight. I think those in diplomacy often want to make sure that there is no public discourse when it comes to negotiations. In fact, the current administration is arguing that the less they share in the process of diplomacy, the more likely a positive outcome in diplomacy. And finally, it sounds as if you're saying we're moving towards this new improvisational leadership, perhaps the movement from what has been a symphonic representation of government to more of a jazz improv type of leader and process towards creating the types of diplomatic relations that we see around the world. Matthias, any final word here? You're in a country where jazz is actually quite popular. Is this something you also see? And I really appreciated your participation today.
Yes. No. What we see is a move to more kind of closer groups. Yes, WhatsApp is being used here in Geneva and in any in Brussels in New York, to coordinate voting at the UN, at diplomatic events. I know foreign ministries create WhatsApp groups with their diplomats on specific campaigns because it's so easy to share a video, a photo that they will then amplify on their channel. So it's quite interesting. And, even going further for politicians, I know the Argentinian president has 300,000 people on WhatsApp, I heard, and the Indian prime minister can reach 1.5 million people on that platform. So this is quite, very, very interesting to mobilize. And to give you another example is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He has a Facebook page with 2.4 million followers, but what he has also, and I think that is much more powerful, is a private group on Facebook with 30,000 members. Now, the beauty of the group is that he can contact choose who will be in, who is in the group. So basically, you don't have detractors, and you can really contact the group members. And I think that is quite interesting. That is a new evolution. For the moment, he is one of the only world leader who is inviting his fans to join that group. So I think that is an interesting evolution. And the last thing is kind of the, how world leaders react to events. And I just wanted to highlight the German foreign ministry when the on the evening of the after the Brexit referendum in the UK in 2016, they basically posted on their social media channels on Twitter, "We are off now to an Irish pub to get decently drunk, and from tomorrow on we will again work for a better Europe." So, that was kind of a heartfelt reaction from the social media team to the events, to the outcome of the Brexit referendum in the UK. And I think, those kind of reactions are, what we need more of. And interestingly, the German foreign ministry is actually quite funny on social media. Every now and then they have very, very funny tweets. So I think that's what I want to see more of, is more, more positive reactions rather than all this negativity.
Well, while we may be witnessing something that we don't usually consider, what we are all witnessing is this tremendous shift and acceleration and disintermediation across the world with the evolution of these social media platforms. It's going to be an exciting time in diplomacy, but also in politics. And I want to thank you both, Charlie and Matthias, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Marcos.
Cheers. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Matthias Lufkin, author of a study which looks at the way Twitter and social networks are used by world leaders, by governments, and by international organizations. Joining Mateus was Charlie Wartzell. He's a columnist for the New York Times who writes on the intersection of media, politics, and technology. This program was moderated by my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.